Save big on your Memorial Day barbecue, all in the Kroger app. Get half gallons of delicious Kroger milk for $1.29 each. Then get flavorful Tyson Natural Boneless Chicken Breasts for $2.49 a pound, all with your card and a digital coupon. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to the Psychovertical Podcast, a weekly podcast about climbing and stuff. I'm your host, Andy Kirkpatrick, Hull's second best climber. That's how I like to describe myself. this week I'm going to talk about what's going on in my life at the moment and talk about climbing partners and how you find them. I had a few questions about that. I'm actually laid in bed. What time is it? It's 7 o'clock in the morning, and I'm in Oman at the moment, still in Oman, and I've been on the road for about a week since the last podcast, like camping and stuff in the mountains. This is very, very cheap way to live. What do I do? So I've been. I'm in a hotel at the moment, which is a it's a very fancy hotel. It's very cheap. It's like the cheapest hotel we could find, but it's like a very good, amazing hotel. Like when we turned up, we looked like basically not washed my clothes because I was only supposed to be away for like a week, and this is like I'm going to be away for like 3 weeks because of the virus thing, and not washed my clothes. Neither of us washed our clothes for like 2 weeks. We've been out in the desert with like Saudi Arabia first. Now we're here. So we look like a bloody state. We look like someone out of a Bear Grylls kind of advert or something. And yeah, we rocked up in this hotel, and someone appeared and gave us like orange juice and water and everything. So anyway, so we Vanessa, for some reason Vanessa doesn't look as bad as I do, but we were in the supermarket, and apparently lots of people looking at my feet because my feet were very dirty, and but people are very I think you often find when you travel to places where you have the greatest reason or excuse for being really, really dirty, you know, having dirty clothes and just being just generally dirty, people seem to be more clean, if you know what I mean. Like if you're in, like, you know, like back or beyond of Kenya or like here or wherever, like where there's like maybe not a lot of water, there's no like people that have washing machines or whatever. Like people are like really spick and span. Like people living in what we'd view as like real squalor. You know, like living in some sort of shanty town. Like people look amazing. Like I said, I don't know why. You know, everyone's like hand washing the clothes and everything else. And the same here. Like it's so dusty in the Gulf that you just get. You know, you go anywhere, like even if you like open the back of your car, you just are constantly covered in dust, and you've got dust on your trousers and everything else. But people are, you know, like so clean. Everyone's wearing like white clothes, while all the men are wearing white clothes, and all the women wearing black. You know, a lot of women wearing black clothes, and black clothes are probably even worse. Show the dust even more. So, like in the cult, in sort of Islamic culture, there's a lot of stuff about cleanliness and washing your hands, washing your feet, and to do with water and stuff. So, is that if you've ever read the book Dune, like Dune? I don't know if Frank Herbert ever lived out in the Gulf, but I think quite a lot about Dune. I think I've read it twice, but it's got this idea of like water being like sacred is I think a lot about that here. I think the water being sacred. And shade, the sacredness of a shade of a tree, because it's very, yeah, it's, you know, you don't see ver- you don't, there's not a lot of tree. So when you see a tree, like, it really has a real, it's got real power to it that you just take for granted if you're living in like Europe, where there's like trees everywhere. And I was saying to Vanessa, like, we actually went and climbed Jebel Shams, which is like the highest mountain in the Gulf. Like, I think if you were gonna, you know, if you got the seven summits, I think really this in the seven summits, the Gulf region should probably be separate, because you've got, you know, you've got the separation between Asia and Europe and Africa, and I feel like the Gulf really deserves to have its own summit, because you got like this, where you got the break between the Suez Canal and you've got Turkey and stuff. I think the Gulf should be like a separate summit. And Jebel Shams, it's about over 3,000 meters high, and we climbed it the other day, and it's like a 12-mile hike up to the top. And there's like a radar station up there, like an Omani like radar station. So it's quite, you can't actually get to the top, which is kind of annoying. So you're following like a trail. It's very well trailed, and you're kind of going up there, and then you think you're at the top, and then you have to go along this ridge that kind of goes up and down, up and up, up and down, and you get to like what is called the top, which is actually like 299 or something. So it's just a little bit lower, which is kind of weird that it's not actually the top, but. It was one of those walks where we just set off, and we just had like, I think we had like 2 liters. It's like winter time, so it's not like mega hot here. So it's kind of highish altitude, but it can get super hot here. So we just had like a jacket, 2 liters of water each, and some tuna mayonnaise and our head torches. And we're not very good at getting up at the moment. We have a tent that we bought from Decathlon, which is a I doubt they sell them anywhere else, but it's basically designed for like out like deserty hot countries, and it's like super light, just can't get through the fly sheet. So when it's all zipped up, it's like reflective whiteish color on the outside, black on the inside, and you basically. It's like being in like a blackout tent, basically. You don't know it's light until you open the tent. So it's kind of cool. So it keeps it much cooler on the inside of the tent. So we're not very good at getting up in the morning. I get up at like 5 o'clock, up as 5 every day anyway. So like kind of on my holidays, I don't like having the alarm on. Anyway, so we woke up, and by the time we actually camped in one of the, like, Oman is just such an amazing place to visit, like I really highly recommend it. And we camped at this place which is basically, I would say, it was like more impressive than the Grand Canyon. It's more compact than the Grand Canyon, but it's just like an incredible place. And you basically, the culture here in the, I'd say that all these of Arab world is basically this culture of like, they really love carpets. They're always like, everyone's got a carpet. They're just like, you know, just stop anywhere. Like, you know, if you'd be driving along and someone just like stopped on the roundabout, and they would have the carpet out, and they'd all be sitting there having some, you know, mint tea or something. So people really love like just stopping in the most random places, getting the carpet out, and the whole family would be sat on the carpet. And even when we were climbing in Saudi Arabia, you know, people would like, in the morning, they would get their carpet out, and they would have the people would have like dates and halva and bread and stuff. So we end up camping like right on the rim, literally like 10 feet from the, like, be like going to Grand Canyon and camping like 10 feet from the edge of the Grand Canyon, and you just drive up there on your 4x4. And anyway, really, really amazing place. And there's amazing. There's an amazing village down in the canyon itself that you can sort of get to, and then there's a Via Ferrata you can climb up out of this village that I doubt many people do. So it's been interesting. So the village is like an abandoned village. One interesting thing as I've been traveling around the last few years, I've been going to a lot of strange kind of sites where you realize that how you know, the idea of like climate change is like something that's the climate's been changing forever. You go to all these places and you read about them, and how, you know, like, not civilizations, but you had like you know, communities living in really strange places to us now, but how you read up on it and how the climate just sort of changed and people couldn't live in this place anywhere. So anyways, but Jebel Shams is a walk. You camp at this one place and then you head up to Jebel Shams from this area. And anyway, so we set off late and we'd been listening to Goggins, Goggins audiobook. I've been traveling around, and that's great. When I put it on, Vanessa was like, I think she was like, oh god, who's this guy? Because he sounds like a bit of a moron, David Goggins. He sounds a bit like me, basically. He sounds like some kind of barely intelligent, kind of barbarian kind of person. So, but anyway, we've been really enjoyed listening to David Goggins. I think it's called Can't Hurt Me. Highly recommend it. Really, really good book. I'll probably do a more of a review of that book, because I think there's some interesting stuff that he doesn't talk about that came to mind when he was talking about himself and stuff. Anyway, so we've been listening to David Goggins' book, so we were getting on it, you know, although we were late. We set, David Goggins would be up at 4 o'clock and he would, you know, be running up there, but we set off a bit late and everybody else had already set off by the looks of it. So we set off up the mountain and it's like one of those rocky trails, just like rocks everywhere. Kind of so not good walking when you're tired, really, that kind of thing. You always feel you're going to break something. And we basically we were passing everybody out on the way up, and there was this is going to sound bad, really, but this is like I'm a big fan of stereotypes and things, in that generally I think like a stereotype is always like 75% true, and you know, people always give an example how it's not true, but that's just like the, you know, the outlier type things. So generally, anyway, walking up this mountain, and there's fucking bags of crisps, like empty bags of crisps, like on the floor of the trail. And because they're, you know, if you're a student of litter, like I am, if a bag of crisps is on the trail, it means whoever dropped it is just in front of you, because a bag of crisps doesn't weigh very much; it blows away. And I said to Vanessa, "I bet you there's Indian people ahead of us." And so I was picking up these bags of crisps and general trash that someone was throwing down, and yes, you know, like a kilometer ahead of us there was like a line of like Indian people who were like, we were just dressed in like shorts and like a long shirt, and they were like, had like down jackets on and everything, like really kind of comical, but they were really, really struggling. But there was loads of them. I couldn't really say like who's dropping litter, so I just didn't say anything. But it's kind of annoying. I do find that Indian people, people from Bangladesh, that those people are fucking terrible at dropping litter. Like absolutely, like terrible. Like culturally, I don't know what is going on. I find that a lot of people I talk to, Arab people, are kind of, they kind of get it. Like, some people really, like British people, like, hate themselves. They absolutely hate themselves. They detest themselves. They detest everything about themselves. They detest their history and their culture and, you know, they love the countryside. They love their nature and things, so they actually have a lot of pride in trying to keep things nice. You know, you'll see one nappy like on the floor next in a car park in like the Peak District or Wales or somewhere, and it's like an outrage, it's like an abomination, it's like the genocide of nature or something, and the reason we find it so offensive, like any kind of litter, is because there's hardly any litter anywhere. Like, it's not like we live in a, you know, if you live in the UK or Ireland or Germany or wherever, I'll ignore Spain because that's kind of quite littery. Any kind of litter is like, oh my god, that's like the worst, you know, it ruins your whole day. Well, anyway, if you come to the Arab world, in a lot of countries, there's like just shitloads of litter. like 1,000 plastic bottles. Like, you go to a campsite, there'll be 1,000 plastic bottles, like, everywhere. There'll be just shit everywhere. There'll be cars that have burnt out. There'll be, like, it's, like, horrendous, really. And so you have to really readjust your life, you know, your brain to that. But a man is kind of different. Like, a man is... But the weird thing is that people, like, love... Like, I would say, like, generally in the Gulf region, and not necessarily thinking about other places, but generally people have this amazing love of their culture and of their religion and of the Sultan and everything else. And if you see a picture of the Sultan or whoever, whoever's ruling over the country, like, hanging down somewhere, people will walk along and they will touch it. You know, like, it really means a lot to people. And some people get it. Like, I've spoken to some people. And they're like, why do people drop litter? Like, why do people, you know, make such a mess? And they really, really... And I think it's probably the same. Like, growing up in the 70s, people didn't really care. People, like, there was a lot more litter around. And, you know, people literally had that idea that... I remember once walking along with a mate of mine, and he was eating a pizza, and he just got the pizza box and he just shoved it into someone's hedge in their house. And I was like, what the hell are you doing? He's like, oh, it's people's jobs. That gives people work, like, leaving litter. And people literally say that to me here, like, the same kind of thing. Like, oh, well, if I didn't drop litter, then who's going to pick it up? Do you know what I mean? So I'm going off topic here, but I do find, like, I hate to say it, I do find, like, Indian people from India do have no, like, you'll just see them just walking along, just, like, just throwing the litter on the floor. You'll see people having, like, a picnic in a really beautiful spot, and literally they'll have, like, a big, you know, thing and have rice in it, like a big, metal container, you know, like a disposable container, and they'll pull the rice out and they'll just throw it, like, literally throw it behind them, like, into the over a hedge or something. And yeah, I find it kind of depressing, but I guess it's like a process, isn't it, of if you go to India, you'll see why it's like that. But yeah, zero tolerance. So anyway, so we passed these people up, and we thought we got, because we were going quite quickly, we got to where we thought the top was going to be, and that wasn't the top. We didn't have a map or anything. So we started going along this ridge, and the ridge was going up and down, up and down, up and up and down. Eventually we got to the top, and that was really, really cool. And we met this, one of the Indian climbers was like, we kind of caught him up on the ridge, and he was like really, he looked like really, really knackered. It really made me think about how, you know, like, non-climbers, they just don't get this idea of that you're only halfway there. You know, like, they're literally, and they can hardly walk, and they've basically got to do a 24-mile day, you know, and they're on, like, mile 11 on top of this mountain, and they're just in a state, and it's like, Christ, man, like, turn around, I just start going back down. So anyway, we got to the top, and it was quite funny because this guy, he suddenly, like, as soon as he got to the summit, he just, like, sprang to life, and he was, like, taking all these, like, selfies, and he was almost like a Bollywood film. Like, he had all these, you know, he was like a spoof of an Indian person. Like, he was just doing all these poses, and he got me to take, I said, oh, I'll take a photograph of you. And he wasn't just, like, just take a photograph of him, like, standing on the summit. He wanted me to take photographs of him, like, laying against the trig point, you know, like, looking like he was tired, like, with his, like, you know, like, those kind of like Hollywood photographs, you know, you'd have your for your aid, you know, to hand out. He was like, he had his hands, like, his face in his hands, and he was, like, doing all these, like, videos of himself. It was, like, hilarious. And then there was another guy there who was a Kuwaiti, it was a Omani soldier who was up there, but he was like, the guy was like, have you got any pain relief? And he was like, oh yeah, yeah. So the guy was like doling out, like, pain relief to this Indian guy, and then he had this, like, kind of deep heat, and the Indian guy was going off and, like, spraying himself. I don't even know what deep heat does, but spraying himself. And I was like, oh, Christ almighty, like, both of them looked like in a total state. And this soldier guy had, like, these really, really, looked like really big desert boots on, which looked way too big for his feet, and he just looked just seeing him struggling. He's so we were sitting on the summit, and the two of them started walking down, and this guy was like really, really struggling walking down, the Omani guy. And he got within about 200 meters away, and then he ran all the way back up, and he was like, "Oh, I didn't get a selfie." And then he took his selfie, and then he like staggered back again. And I was like, "Oh God, this is gonna be like a shit show going down there with all these people." So anyway, so we took our photographs. I went down the trail, and just all the people we'd passed coming up, none of them got to the top. They'd all turned around, and as you were passing them out, it looked like the retreat from Russia, Napoleon's armies retreating from Moscow or something. Like everyone was like staggering, and they had like fucking miles to go. You know, they had like 10 miles to go, and they were like staggering, and those people with sticks, and they were like, "Have you got any do you have any pain relief? Do you have got any medicine or anything?" And we're like, "No, we haven't, sorry." And kept on going, and as we were going, we started picking up as much litter as we could, because there isn't a lot of litter on that mountain, so it's kind of it's more obvious. But we managed to get one of these giant, like 50 liter, somehow there's a 50 liter ginormous like water container up there, so I managed to like strap that onto my rucksack, and was going down and picking up more bags of crisps and stuff. So these people were like littering coming up, which are picking up the litter, and when I was going down, they were like littering going down, so I was like picking up litter coming up behind them. And so we passed them all out, and we got back down to the car just as it was getting dark. We didn't really take enough water. We needed a bit more water. It was, as we're walking down, we found there was a plastic bag. It had like about 4 2-liter bottles of water in it, and it had like a can of Coke in it. And we'd passed some guys coming up with like big rucksacks on, and Vanessa was like, "Oh God, maybe we should drink some of that water." And I was like, "No, I think maybe they've stashed that water," but they didn't stash it very well, so maybe we should stash it. We were like, no, we'll just keep on going. We can get down without drinking any of that water. And then so it was like, this, what would Goggins do? That's kind of, kept saying that. What would Goggins do? Anyway, so we managed to get down. Went to our camping spot in the dark. Really, really amazing, beautiful night. Anyway, then we're looking up, and you can just see all these lights coming down in the dark of these Indian people, like coming down the mountain. And I'm sure like some of them end up sleeping up there. It's like very warm. They're not going to die. And Vanessa's like, "Do you think we should do something?" And I'm like, "No, I don't think we should do anything. Like, they're not going to die, and they're littering bastards. It'll serve them right." So I always have this idea that the more you like pick up other people's litter, the more you know, like seeing litter is an excuse. Like if you look at the litter and it makes you really, really angry, but you don't do anything about it, then you're just as kind of complicit anyway. So I got that from my dad, probably. I remember, like, as a kid, going walking with my dad, and he would, like, pick up other people's litter, and it just becomes a thing. And it becomes almost like a thing where you just think, this is giving me good, the mountain will appreciate this, you know. I won't be the one who's, like, you know, got horrendous blisters and, you know, cut and having to sleep out all night long, you know, in the rocks. So, but anyway, we've been climbing and travelling out here, and the climbing is okay. Like, I've not been climbing much this year, so I've got a quick drink of my tea. 1 second. We've not been climbing that much, and the grades kind of go up and down. So I was like failing on like five tens and things, and it's always kind of depressing. I've got like a hole in my boot. I wear like TC Pros, and whenever I go away somewhere like this, I always seem to have like a hole in my boots. That was an excuse, having a hole in my boots. But I'm quite good at like slab climbing, but a lot of the climbing here is like limestone. It's a bit steeper, so I'm not very good at that kind of thing. So, but yeah, been to some interesting places. I wouldn't say this was the place to come, you know, if you were like, you know, Alex Magos or somewhere, this is probably not the place to come. But for adventurous, you know, driving to some wadi, you know, doing some climbing, you know, just sleeping out in the desert, yeah, it's like really cool place to visit. It's probably getting a bit too hot now, but a lot of the wadis where you climb are in places that are like in shady areas, and we climbed at somewhere which is must be getting on for like 2,500 meters, and it's actually quite cold in the sun, and it gets windy, and it can get really cold out here. Right, you know, you should never underestimate how cold it can get in the, you know, sort of deserty, arid places. I guess I should mention the virus again. When we were in Saudi, basically we didn't want to go to the country we're living in because it all sounded a bit fucked up, and we didn't want to go into quarantine or basically, you know. I think one thing about this virus, I think it like shows two things. It shows about the how out of control the media is, which is something I'm always talking about. You know, it kind of feeds into this whole, you know, there's a lot of money in panic and hysteria, basically, is getting your customer base, like, you know, it's like Cabbage Patch Kids, you know what I mean? You know, tell everyone this, you know, it's that kind of thing. Like, people go fucking crazy, you know, trying to buy the latest thing at Christmas. I see this as a similar kind of thing. Like 1.6 million people die every year of diabetes, which is primarily caused by, you know, poor shit dietary advice. But no one ever talks about shit like that, you know. So there's no money in it. So we, and the other thing is kind of it's I guess it's what do you call it? You know, kind of like, what's it, not corporate cowardice, institutional cowardice, basically. Like, everyone is trying to cover their asses that they did the right thing, you know. They were going to close the borders, you know. We're going to make sure everyone stays in the houses, you know. All this kind of, you know, it's like people like, I'm going to prove that I'm the, you know, so no one's ever going to, you know, question me or going to get into trouble about it. So instead of people saying like, look, people are going to die, we can't do anything about it, you know, we can try our best, but, you know, it's impossible. Impossible situation. We're just gonna have to try our best, and that's it. And all people are gonna die, you know. That's how it is, you know. That's how it is. It's not the Black Death. It's not Ebola. And calm the fuck down, basically. But no one's gonna say that because, you know, oh my God, that'd be terrible. So anyway, so we had to decide. We didn't want to go back to this where we live because it'd just be a shit show, basically. And you know, the whole Stalin thing of no people, no problem. Like, this is a really good example of it. Is when you're in like the biggest danger of the virus is to do with people and institutions and how they handle it. So you really want to be in a place where there's as few people as possible. Ideally, you want to be in a country which has about 4 million people or less. And Vanessa was like, why don't we go to Turkey? Because it's like, and I was like, no, let's not go to Turkey. Like, Turkey has got like 80 million people in it. Let's go to a country where there's not many people. Like, 4 million people is I reckon a country with between 4 and 5 million people is the ideal size of a country. So think of like Norway, Ireland. There's like, I think there's something about a country that's 4 million people is like perfect. And have them all spread out. Like, don't have like 4 million people living in like one place, you know, in one city, like a city state, in like a QA or something like that. You want to have all those people spread out. So we came here. So that was you know, I've only seen one person with a mask on here in the supermarket. So no, it's kind of a, you know, I think basically you'll get this fatigue where people are like, fuck, we can't do anything about this. We'll just have to go. We'll just have to run with it. And people just can't. Well, they just have to calm the fuck down. You can't stop it. But I do find the thing about self isolation, the idea of self isolation, is really, it's a really great term, because I think we are living in a self isolating society anyway. In the, do you know, if you go to a supermarket and they have all these like automatic checkouts, you don't have to deal with a human being. I think people tend to gravitate to those anyway, because I think we don't actually like to interact with people so much. You know, this idea of being, we're all like really atomized. You know, we're atomized from our, you notice it here because people are so family orientated. Like the pillars of Saudi society is like religion and family. And you know, the culture is like totally different. You know, that's why you have a carpet. You know, that's why you have a big carpet that you carry around with you. Not literally, but you have a big carpet. So the whole family can get on the carpet. Where, you know, in the West, you know, you probably just need like a bath towel, you know, because there's only you really. You're the only person that matters. You know, you have no time for your parents or your kids, or, you know, you're self-isolating the whole time, totally atomized. You live, you know, 1,000 miles from your mom and 10,000 miles from your dad, and you never speak to your kids, and you live with this person, but you're always on your mobile phone, or you're always distracted about other shit going on in your life. So, you know, I think we're kind of self-isolating. And I think increasingly we're probably self-isolating within ourselves. Like this whole thing, you know, white privilege, all that kind of shit. It's basically making you, you know, like separating yourself from yourself in a way, you know, like hating yourself or, you know, and you know, that kind of thing. You know what I'm talking about. So the virus thing. Yeah, it'd be funny. I bet it won't even be a thing. You know, in a month's time, it'll be a nothing. It'd be like World War III that was going to happen not long ago. I'll just mention the book, the Down book. So I've had to take 2 weeks off trying to finish that off. And at the moment, I've been doing like the layout of the book, which seems to be taking me a long time. And I think the reason was I've tried to make it too fancy, like the layout. I should just have text images, do it that way. And I've tried to make it look a bit too nice and whatever. And it's one of these things where when you're laying a book out, you know, you're laying it out and suddenly you're like, oh, I think the font is too small. And then you change the font and then everything has to be changed. And then you're like, oh, the headings don't look quite right. And I can't really tell the hierarchy of the text, and you change your heading and everything goes. So it's just been a bit of a nightmare of making sort of stupid mistakes and not having a real solid base for this book. So I'm having to sort of go back a little bit and just make it a little bit simpler. And also I'm still getting like feedback from people. So I sent out some chapters of the book to people for just to get some feedback and also get some quotes for the book. So I had a good quote from like Pete Whitaker and various people. But Sean O'Driscoll, I can't remember his, I can't remember his pronounce his proper name, you know, like ace Belgian rock climbing dude. So he had an interesting thing. He was saying about using fishing line. So if you're in really, really windy conditions, is when you're pulling the rope down, usually when the rope goes through the anchor at the top, the abseil anchor, is if it's super windy, then the end of the rope generally like whips off and it can very easily get caught on a rock or something if you're in Patagonia or in bad weather. So he had this thing about using fishing line, where you attach fishing line to the end of the rope, so as you're pulling the rope down, it's attached to this fishing line, so the rope just comes down on the fishing line, and you carry about 200 meters of fishing line like on a reel or something, and then you sort of reel it all back in again. It sounds a bit crazy, but so that's the kind of thing. I have to add that to the book. So it's one of these projects that I just cannot wait to get this fucking book finished, because I've got lots of other books I want to get on with, and it's just lots of people are waiting for this book, and this book must be like at least a year late now. So I do apologize. It will be worth it. Like, I think this book's going to be a game changer for a lot of like new climbers and things, and people like Sean and people who are Paul Pritchard. You know, they've all said, even just I only sent them like one chapter, but they're like, oh, like they learned like there was stuff in it they didn't know and stuff. So I really want to get on with this. I want to do this kids book, Superlexia it's called, which is kind of like a book for kids, like a, you know, how old, what kind of kid, age kids would be. And I want to get on with this bear pit book, this kind of fictional book that I've half written. So I do apologise. I should be back working on this in about like a week or something. And I'm just going to, like, I feel like I've been like hammering at it for like forever, like just like 12 hour days on it for like forever. And it just seems to just not be getting finished. But anyway, on the subject of writing, it was funny. I'll just mention this, but because I've done a few podcasts about relationships and that kind of thing, I've probably never had so much feedback or like, you know, people's saying nice things or you know, like responding to stuff I've done as I have with these podcasts. So I really appreciate that. Even if you just like it, they're shit. And I was responding to somebody about something, relationship kind of stuff. Because I'm really interested in relationships and things. I think that's, you know, I think we're really bad at. A friend of mine, she was doing something on Radio 4 or some BBC radio thing. About women apologize more than men and all this kind of stuff. And I said like how men just kill themselves. I've got this idea, this thing that human beings are really, really bad at communicating, and we put like too much value onto what people say, because we don't even understand the real meaning or the value of what we're saying. We just go through the motions. We're just like saying the things that people want to hear, and the things we want to say, the things we want to hear us say, but they have no real truth to them, whatever. Like, we're very bad at communicating as humans. We're very good at sending a signal, but we're very bad at interpreting signals. And even the machinery that is creating that signal to send is generally pretty, you know, it's not very good. It's not very sophisticated. Like, even if it was, you probably would never say anything. You're probably just trying to deal with it, really. Because if you're sending a signal out, like a mayday, and the people who are responding are sending back, you know, like a response that is probably just as dangerous or going to put you into more harm, then anyway, what's the point? Just work it out for yourself. But I wrote something in this email to someone, and then I just thought it's a good point to make, so I just like stuck it on Instagram, and I just had a picture of a boot I'd seen on a beach somewhere, like an army boot. So I just put that image up there, and then often you have like some words and you don't have anything that fits it, so sometimes just something that's random, just stick it up there. And I just said like, people who don't know what they want most often don't want what they have once they have it. And it's a simple kind of thing. We do meet a lot of people. I've been like this myself, where you're kind of very confused, and you're really driven to get this thing in your life, like a person or a relationship or whatever. But the confusion, like if you really want something, you always got to ask yourself why. Like in the last podcast, I was saying about, why does someone want to go climbing with you? You know, what reason is there for them want to go climbing with you? Like, you should really think about it. And what's the reason you want to be with somebody or have a relationship with somebody or own something or climb something or get that job, whatever? Like, it's really good to really, don't bullshit yourself, like really, really dig down into it. I remember once I was like, I was really obsessed once with this woman, and someone like a long time in my life, met this woman just like randomly from this thing. Anyway, I thought in my head I'd kind of fallen in love with this person, and just kind of became a little bit obsessed. You know, but I was married at the time, So nothing actually happened with this thing. But you had all these like, but this and this person just kind of came and then disappeared out of my life, and just moved somewhere else or whatever. And I just became kind of fixated with this woman, and I'd sometimes have dreams and this woman being in my dreams or whatever. And it was like it would make me really sad and depressed thinking about this woman, because she represented something that was wrong with my own marriage and whatever. And it was over such a long period that I couldn't even remember what this woman looked like, but she kind of represented something in my life. And just thought about her so much. And I'd like, sometimes I'd be walking through Sheffield and I'd just be like, just hoping I would bump into her, because to meet her and see her would be like the most amazing thing, the most amazing gift. It'd be like, it's hard, I can't even put into words how it would feel. Like if anyone's felt like this about somebody else. You know, but men are much more obsessive like this than women. Women don't seem to have this in them, and I'd be interested to dig down why this is. And but anyway, like, but like years and years later, maybe like 15 years later, I was, you know, I got divorced and I'm single, and and I was like really trying to. I mean, you know, when you get divorced, it's like the worst thing that's ever going to happen. One of the worst things in your life, apart from your kids dying or something. And I was like really trying to sort out my shit, like sort out what was going on with myself, because really, like, you should really work out what was the problem. You know, why did you get in this position where you end up getting divorced and everything else? Like, don't make the same mistakes again. Like, don't just go through life making the same fucking mistakes. So I ended up, like, somehow I managed to get the contact details of this woman, and I sent her this email. I was like, hi, you probably don't even remember me, and blah blah blah. I met you all these years ago, and for some reason I was like, I got like totally obsessed with you, and I don't know why, and I'd really like to like just like put a line underneath that. I'd love to like meet you sometime, and it's not kind of weird. I'm not going to kill you or stalk you or whatever, but it'd just be like kind of. It'd be good to just have one of these things in your life that you just put a line through. And so through a mutual friend, and kind of got this reply like, oh, I've just finished in this like long-term relationship and I've just moved back to Sheffield, and yeah, it'd be like really cool to meet up or something. So I was like, so this is like super me being like super brave here, because it's not really in my style really. So we met up and we had a drink and stuff, and so we'll go and have some food or something. We had some food and blah blah blah, and it was like really weird. Like, she was still like this really really great person, whatever, but this she was in no way this person that I had thought she was. And then and then anyway, so the night finished, and I give her a hug. So I go, oh, it's been great to meet you. Thanks for me. Anyway, so we walked off, and then I felt like this kind of amazing feeling of like just dealing with this shit. And then the next day, I was in the park with my kids, and I bump into her, and it's like weird. You know, you go through like 15 years like trying to bump into this person, and you like bump into her like the next day, and so we're like talking again and everything, and I'm being like Mr. Dad, all that kind of stuff. Anyway, I went away, and then the friend of mine got in touch with me, who'd got us in touch together, and she's like, oh, by the way, like, you know, I think he saw you the other day, and she, you know, maybe you should like, you know, keep after it, because, you know, maybe you might, you know, I think she likes you, whatever. And I'm like, nah, you know. so people are so weird, like, you know what I mean, like, why? That's the thing, you just have to try and dig down into this kind of shit in your life, and it's nothing to, often it's nothing to do with that person. So this person who's totally obsessed with you or whatever, or you're totally obsessed with them, or, you know, it's nothing to do with you or them. Like, as soon as they get what they want, there's nothing to do with that at all, and it'll just get wet. They'll just go, you know, make things worse, whatever. So I shared that little bit of advice about, you know, you don't, what you want, to decide what you really want. And I had like an email from someone saying how it, like, this thing had come at exactly the right time in their lives, to read that. I don't know what was going on in their lives, But it's funny about writing and trying to be honest when you write, you know, when you're in these things, is how it can have. It just has to arrive at the right time in someone else's life. You know, it's like why would I just post that and just arrives at the same time in someone else's life that they need to hear that. So those kind of interventions, is it an intervention? I don't know. But I've always really appreciated people who just said the truth to me. People who knew how to communicate and they just said the truth to me. They just said, like, you're a fucking coward, or, you know, or whatever. Like, I remember Ian Parnell once told me I was a coward, and it was probably one of the best bits of advice. You know, you're this person who can do all this, like, really, really extreme kind of shit and be really brave, but deep down you're a coward. And I'm sure Ian probably didn't even remember saying this, but, like, that really hurt me. But it was, like, the best advice, you know. And the people in my life, people like, you know, like Dick Turnbull and, you know, various people in my life, the people some people are actually almost like strangers, but we have these kind of, we've had like interactions through emails over the last, you know, over years and years and years, and don't even, you know, never really met them. But, you know, some people are just really good at like snapping you out of it, of making you, you know, stopping you from bullshitting yourself, really, who just know how to send that signal, you know, send that kind of correct signal that you cannot misinterpret. So keep it simple. Don't be too, like, when you're dealing with people who are having like relationship problems, I always think you want to keep any kind of interaction with them down to like a paragraph or a line, because you're just feeding something that's a negative force in them. They just want to talk about it forever. So onto the climbing stuff. I've been thinking about I need to break this podcast down into different podcasts completely, have a completely separate podcast, three podcasts, one which is like this, and then one that's just about the geary type of stuff, and one that's about nothing to do with climbing whatsoever. But as ever, I just can't get around to doing it. So Vanessa's gone off for a run this morning, so I have to get this done before she gets back. So it is what it is. So anyway, so we're going to finish off with quite a few questions about climbing partners, finding climbing partners. And as ever, I looked at my blog, see if I've written anything about climbing partners, and I did have a climbing partner related question on there. So I'm just going to read you the reply. So as usual, I've not done my due diligence. I've not actually read this reply. I've not read what I've written. So I'm just going to read it out now, and maybe there'll be something of interest in there. So this is my reply to that. So anyway, people often ask me why I used to solo as much. Alex Huber, who's no mean soloist himself, even going as far as suggest it was some form of self-sabotage. In reality, the reason for all these solo trips, the Troll Wall, climbing the Alps, Yosemite, was that I either just couldn't find anyone to climb with, thought myself too crap to climb with good people that might go, or did not trust those who were available to climb. So basically, three reasons for me is that it's actually quite hard to find people to climb with sometimes. If you want to go where, you know, it's sometimes hard to find people to climb with, you know, if you want to go climbing along on a Saturday or something. But if you want to go to, you know, climb Denali or climb Aconcagua, it's like really, really hard. And that's often why people go on these organized trips or have a guide, even, because they can just pay to go with somebody else, and it just makes it easier. But it's way better to have a climbing partner, and that's one of the most important aspects of climbing, probably. You know, people talk about your training and stretching and all that kind of stuff, but no one ever talks about the climbing partner and having a good climbing partner, someone who you feel is better than you and they feel you're better than them, is like really, really important. Like super, super important, because even if you don't do anything, you'll have so much more fun. And some climbing partnerships don't work out very well. Like I climbed with Paul Ramsden quite a few times, went on trips to like Alaska and, you know, all sorts of places, Patagonia and stuff. And I think we came to the conclusion that we were actually not very good at climbing together, because I think we both thought the other person was too good in a way. Maybe Paul doesn't agree, but I always thought that Paul was too good for me. And then we went to try and climb the Harlan on the Eiger, and he said that he said something that it made me think that, oh god, he thinks I'm better than he is or something. So I think we just put a line under that. But then Paul, you know, Paul is like a great climber, and just climbed really well with Nick Bullock, and, you know, won loads of Pilet d'Ors and stuff. But sometimes you just cancel each other out, really. And then another aspect is feeling you're too crap to climb with other people. Now, I know people who, a friend of mine, Jane, who like soloed El Cap and all, and people like that, who, you know, people think they're like these super hardcore people, but really they just think they're too shit to climb with anybody else, and they'd rather just bumble the way up of these things, or, you know, just no one can see how shit you are when you're by yourself, and how you just, you know, weak and feeble, and you can go at your own pace. You know, there's nothing worse than being tied to someone who's a bit faster than you if you're on a glacier or something. So that's another aspect of it. And there's also, like, basically, often the people who want to go climbing with you, you just don't trust them. You don't trust their motives. You don't trust the fact that they will not just get to somewhere and just flake out or lose their, you know, they have these kind of romantic notions of what climbing is. And those people, like, kind of Walter Mitty kind of characters. It's like, basically, there's more Walter Mitty's in the world than there is not. So, you know, so those people are not good to climb with, those kind of people. They'll promise you the world and you'll get there, and they won't deliver anything, and they'll just, you know, they could kill you or whatever, or they could kill themselves. And those kind of people are worth avoiding, and there's lots of them, generally Americans. So I'll keep on reading. In the past, there was a small pool of climbers who could try and link up with. Ian Parnell and Paul Ramsden being the people I climbed with a lot, but as they get older, they either stop going on big trips, or work, family curtailed the number or length of trips, or they just wanted different objectives. For example, after trying the Harlan with Paul, he just said, "I'll leave this stuff up to you," and switch mainly to high altitude mountaineering as it fitted better with his life. So there you go, that's that story. The pool of climbers has leagues: Premier, First Division, Second Division, and once you begin to establish yourself in one league by some hard climbs, you might be able to find someone to play with. Examples of this are young climbers like Callum Musket or Tom Livingstone, who in doing some hard routes like Divine Providence or the Long Hope route, for example, appear on the radar of older climbers who think maybe they can piggyback their ambition on a younger climber's drive. Patrick Gabarou is a great example of this, as well as Twid Turner. The older climber takes the younger climber on, and the younger climber picks up all the stuff they need to know beyond the purely technical, that mountain sense. Yeah, so that is, like, I think Paul Ramsden's going on a trip soon with two, like, young climbers to Nepal, I think. And that seems to have been away for a long time. And I'm sure, like Nick Bullock is like a phenomenal climber, phenomenal mountaineer. But I know that Nick Bullock has learned like shitload from Paul Ramsden. Now, Paul Ramsden is probably younger than Nick Bullock. But Paul Ramsden looks like he's about 1,000 years old. Like when I first met Paul Ramsden, I think he was the same age as me, but he looked like he was about 40 years old. He's just got that kind of look about him. And he's been climbing, I think he climbed Northwest Eiger when he was like 18 or 19, and he's just got like a phenomenal amount of experience. And I'm sure Nick like learnt a lot from like Paul Ramsden. And it's the same, you know, so Twid Turner is the same. You know, like, so it's very important to go climbing with older climbers. And often younger climbers as well, like younger climbers will push you as an older climber. You know, they just do, really. Like, I know, like, Vanessa, my wife, is like 12 years younger than me or something, and she like pushes me, you know, so it's very you know, it's like it's very important. I'll probably be saying all this, and I'll just be appearing in my in what I'm writing anyway. So age is not always a factor, as Nick Bullock and Paul Ramson's partnership has worked out well. And although both are the same age and both are hardcore in their way, Paul has a very wide mountain experience, doing it since he was a kid, where Nick started in his 30s. This means both bring something to the partnership that works out, and often stuff that's far removed and important from the purely physical. Finding your partners often seems to be about establishing links early, say at university. And although I didn't go to university, almost all the great alpine climbers of my generation did, and some formed some very strong partnerships that way. Once they dispersed, each would pick up new partners, and these, in turn, would be added to the group, one member vouching for the new blood. So for me, growing up in... growing up as a climber in Sheffield, you had two groups basically. You had the Leeds climbers, the Sheffield climbers, and like the Edinburgh climbers. They were like the three main ones. So you had Jamie Andrews, and Jules Cartwright and people up in Scotland. And you had the Benson twins and Rich Cross and Al Powell and Kenton Cool, and all these people like in this kind of these separate like university people. You know, some of them went on, like Kenton became like super guide, and you know, some amazing climbers, so they would just kind of pick up, you know, they created this core of really really cool climbers. And then they would, like, I think the Leeds lot, they went off to try and climb the Ogre and stuff, you know, went to the university. So super, super, super good climbers. And nearly all those climbers went on to become mountain guides, or they died. Like, it's interesting, nearly all the Edinburgh climbers died. I don't know why that is. So starting these, like, really strong relationships early on. And also it's kind of very promiscuous, is that, you know, people will, once they know that you can climb well with somebody else, then they will often get in touch and climb with other people. So like Kenton would be climbing with, you know, with various people. You know, he was climbing with like Ian Parnell and Nick Bullock and Al Powell and various people. And it's very, you know, there's like a group of people. For some reason, apart from Ian Parnell, like I think I never seemed to be very good at like establishing like good climbing partnerships with people, and I think it's mainly one reason is I'm a bit of a weirdo, and probably people thought that I would just say shit about them, probably like I would like, you know, write about them or whatever. So there's various reasons why these things happen. Maybe that's why I end up soloing things. So climbing with strangers can be dangerous on single pitch crags. So big gnarly routes is out of the question. It's not if you know something about them. For example, when I tried the Russian route on the Eiger, I had never met my two climbing partners until the day we set off. But I knew Neil had climbed some really hard walls, climbed in Patagonia, while Ross had less experience, had been in the Royal Marines and worked as a mountain leader. Yes, that was weird, going to the Eiger. I was supposed to be going with Aldo Kane, who's like getting quite famous now, and his twin brother. And I climbed El Cap with Aldo, and I really liked him. And he wasn't like super experienced for doing something on the North Face of the Eiger, like spending like 3 weeks on North Face of the Eiger on trying to do this Russian route. But I knew we'd have a good time. So that was more important, you know. It's like a lot of climbing partnerships. It's if you're going on a long thing, it's like, can you get on with somebody? And someone told me that was how some Norwegian friend who's like Norwegian Special Forces. He said that was a big thing when you're interviewing people. It's like, could I spend like a month in a snow hole with this person? It doesn't matter how strong they are or whatever. It's like, can I just get on with this person? And I suppose you're going there with Aldo and his twin brother, and I thought, well, I know Aldo, so his twin brother's going to be exactly the same. And what happened was Aldo ended up breaking his shoulder like the week before, so I had to find someone else. I ended up finding Neil Charlton, who was like super hardcore, like big wall climber. But it turned out he'd never done any like winter climbing before, and he'd never even put crampons on, I don't think. And so I ended up like meeting them in Kleiner Scheidegg or something, and having never met them before, either of them, and going up on the Russian route on the Eiger, which is probably the hardest route on the northwest of the Eiger, and being up there for like a week. And we had a really great time, but we didn't do it. So but it can. I've actually climbed with a shitload of people who I had never met before. So a lot of this is probably isn't actually doesn't really appropriate. So I did this the first time I climbed El Cap in a day with 2 19-year-old guys who just met at the base. They had the experience and drive, but just didn't see themselves as ready to climb El Cap in a day. When I did, I was not too concerned if we just had to push the top if you didn't make it. If you feel you can carry a climb on your shoulders, leading every pitch and take on apprentices, then this is a great way of getting on hard routes. For example, Cedar Wright just asked about my route on Ulvatana, maybe wanting to repeat it with Alex Honnold and Korodanka, a heavy hitting team, when the route was climbed by a team who had pretty much never climbed before. So when I went to Ulvatana in Antarctica, you know, never climbed with them. Sorry, need to open the door for my wife to get back in. You'd never climb with any of those people. And I'm going mobile now. This is amazing. Going mobile. I'm still doing my podcast. So, never climb with any of those. Well, I climb with Alex Gamma. But never climb with any of those people. So you find yourself in this super extreme place on this super extreme climb with absolute strangers. So, but that kind of takes a lot of experience, I guess, of climbing with people you don't know. If you cannot find climbing partners like this, then things can be tough. Searching through UKC is probably not the way for anything gnarly, but joining a Facebook group like UK Big Wall Climbing might be better. The problem is often climbers have very little time and don't want to take a chance on an unknown and risk the chance of that person being a logjam or just being deluded. Yosemite is full of climbers who have teamed up with the wrong partner who just falls on day one or as soon as things get tough. The one safe way to find find partners is to go to a climbing club for a long enough time to establish a small reputation that you're not deluded or will be a logjam. The best place for this, of course, would be Yosemite, as living cheek to jowl with so many climbers makes this connection easier. Somewhere like Chamonix, Squamish, El Chaltén, Boulder, Sheffield, Springdale would be next. But here climbers are more fragmented and in tribes. So I'd probably add, you know, places like, Rapalies. You know, it's like there's certain places where you could just go and you would start establishing climbing partnerships with people. And one of the best things to do as a climber, I reckon, is to go to a Rapalies for like 3 months. You know, pack in your job, go to Rapalies for 3 months, just live in a Rapalies, and just meet climbers there. There's like shitloads of climbers, and often you'll meet climbers and they'll have friends. And once you've climbed with them, then their friends will turn up and you climb with them, and then you just end up like climbing like that. You'll meet other people who are there for a long time, and so that's a very good way of like establishing this, you know, like a resume, you know. And then you go back and people, you know, get an Instagram account, a photograph of you doing punks in the gym, you know, oh, he's done punks in the gym, he must be quite a good climber. And, you know, establishing that kind of a resume of things. Like when you have to apply for a grant, if you're going to apply for like Mount Everest Foundation grant or something, you have to provide like a resume of all your experience. And I once saw Twid's resume, and it was like fucking amazing. It was like about 50 pages long, and it was unbelievable. It was probably one of the most impressive climbing resumes I've ever read in my life. Just went on and on and on and on. It was like amazing. So, you know, when you read something like that, you're like, well, this person knows what he's doing. So if it's only got like one thing, that's not probably, you know, climbed like, you know, done the red route in the climbing wall, that's probably not so good. So so just going to one place long enough to establish people know who you are, people trust you, that's a good way of like building up climbing relationships in that one place, and then hopefully getting enough experience that you can translate that when you go, you know, back to other places. Another factor is year on year, few people want to do hard alpine climbing. This can be seen by climbers applying for Mount Everest grants going down. So the pool is getting very small. On the plus side, a smaller pool combined with partnerships coming to an end. Look how Leah Holdings partnerships have changed since Ulvatana, means that there are always others looking for someone to link up with. And back to the solo stuff. Climbers like Neil Charlton and Sean Warren seem to get onto the radars of other climbers by their solo climbs, and so free themselves up from all the hassle of people and all their drama. And the most difficult aspect of climbing. Don't remember what I'm saying there, but basically, people like Neil and Sean, they went off, you know, soloing some hard routes, and that's how they established a reputation. And without all the hassle of dealing with, you know, instead of going to Yosemite and trying loads of walls with other people, random people, they just went and soloed them. As for me, coming off 3 months of climbing with another human, my solo days seem to be behind me. I just found a climber I liked hanging out with, who I trusted and wanted to climb with, and then I married her. So I don't know if that's got any real advice there, really. But as I say, it's really important to get like a good climbing partnership. Climbing clubs also can be quite good. I think I mentioned before joining the Irish Mountaineering Club and meeting lots of interesting climbers there. But if you want it, I think the scope of that blog was actually more to do with like gnarly stuff. If you want to do gnarly stuff, that is much harder to find gnarly climbers. Like I think if you want to do gnarly stuff, then you really have to try and somehow build up some kind of resume somehow or other, and then try and, you know, join like the alpine climbing group or something, or join, you know, try and write about your adventures so people know who you are. Like I guess that's how I did it. You know, like I probably wrote about my first trip to Yosemite, and then I ended up getting asked to go with Andy Perkins, who was like my hero because he'd read something I'd read, you know. So that kind of way is a way of doing it if you want to do like gnarly stuff. You know, if you've got no one to climb with, you know, like doing some sort of guided trips, like going to climb Denali, maybe on a guided trip, climb Aconcagua, just establish yourself that you have got like a base of experience, is kind of helpful. And now you've got the internet now. It's so easy to interact with people. Is you know, just send emails to people. Like I could probably get like 10 emails every day from like young climbers and people asking questions and things, I think less and less people want to do that kind of stuff. People seem to be more focused on work. And also maybe that kind of climbing is something, maybe it's best saved for later in life as well. Like if you're 21 and you want to get on doing like super hard gnarly, you know, like winter alpine mountaineering things, like maybe those things are better to do when you're a little bit older, like when you're in your 30s, when you're a little bit safer, a little bit more cautious, you have more kind of experience in the tank and all that kind of stuff. Maybe when you're in your 20s, you're better focusing more on, like, you know, rock climbing, just getting the mileage in. But I don't, yeah, I don't really know. It's a difficult one. But just, yeah, if it means that much to you, then you'll do it. You'll find a way. And if it doesn't mean that much, then you won't. You'll take up something else instead. Take up golf or something. Okay, so that I shall sign off now. Vanessa is back from the gym, from the running around outside. And again, if you like this podcast, please share it. Any questions, send them to me. And that's it. So goodbye until next time.
Save big on your Memorial Day barbecue, all in the Kroger app. Get half gallons of delicious Kroger milk for $1.29 each. Then get flavorful Tyson Natural Boneless Chicken Breasts for $2.49 a pound, all with your card and a digital coupon. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.